Chapter 29. Lake Como, London. For the next 3 days, they put her gently through her paces. They described the sumptuous meals she would not eat, the boozy cocktail parties she would not attend, and the deeply boring seminars that, mercifully, she would be spared. They took her on a frigid cruise of the lake and a long drive through the mountains. They filled her suitcases with gifts and brochures for her colleagues, and they anxiously awaited the hour of her departure. There was not one among them who doubted her authenticity, and not one who wanted to send her back to Russia. When it came time to leave, she marched onto her plane the way she had come off it 3 days earlier, with her chin up and at a parade ground clip. That night, they huddled around the secure communications link, waiting for the flash from Moscow that she had arrived safely. It came, much to their relief, a few minutes after midnight. Shumail Peled followed her home and pronounced her tale clean as a whistle. The following morning, from her desk at Galaxy Travel, Irina sent an email to Veronica Ricci of Nita, thanking her for the wonderful trip. Signora Ricci asked Ms. Volganova to stay in touch. Gabriel was not present in Como to witness the successful end of the operation. Accompanied by Olga Sukova, he flew to London the morning after the interrogation and was immediately whisked to a safe flat in Victoria. Graham Seymour was waiting and subjected Gabriel to a 10-minute tirade before finally permitting him to speak. After first insisting that the microphones be switched off, Gabriel described the remarkable debriefing they had just conducted on the shores of Lake Como. Seymour immediately placed a secure call to Thames House and posed a single question. Did a woman bearing a Russian passport in the name of Natalia Primakova arrive at Heathrow Airport aboard Aeroflot Flight 247 on the afternoon of January the 10th? Thames House called back within minutes. The answer was yes. I'd like to schedule a meeting with the Prime Minister and my Director General right away. If you're willing, I think you should be the one to brief them. After all, you proved us all wrong, Gabriel. That gives you the right to rub our noses in it.
I have no intention of rubbing your noses in anything. And the last thing I want you to do is mention any of this to your Prime Minister or Director General. Grigory Bulganov is a British subject, and as such has owed all the protections offered by the British Crown. We have no choice but to present our evidence to the Russians and insist that they return him at once.
Ivan Karkov went to a great deal of trouble to get Grigory, in all likelihood with the blessing of the FSB and the Kremlin itself. Do you really think he's going to hand him over because the British Prime Minister insists on it?
We have to play the game by the same rules as Ivan.
Meaning? We have to steal him back.
Graham Seymour made one more phone call, then pulled on his overcoat.
Heathrow Security is getting us pictures.
You and Olga stay here, and do try to keep the gunfire to a minimum. I have enough problems at the moment.
But Gabriel did not remain in the safe flat for long. Indeed, he slipped out a few minutes after Seymour's departure and headed directly to Cheyne Walk in Chelsea. Once a quiet riverside promenade, this historic London street now overlooked the busy Chelsea Embankment. On some of the grand houses were brass plaques commemorating famous occupants of the past. Turner had lived secretly at number 119, Rossetti at number 19, Henry James had spent his final days at number 21, George Eliot had done the same at number 4. These days, few artists and writers could afford to live in Cheyne Walk. It had become the preserve of wealthy foreigners, pop stars, and moneymen from the city. It also happened to be the London address of one Viktor Orlov, exiled Russian oligarch and Kremlin critic, who resided at the five-story mansion at number 43. The same Viktor Orlov who was now the target of a clandestine investigation being conducted by a team of burrowers at King Saul Boulevard. Gabriel entered the small park across the street and sat down on a bench. Orlov's house was tall and narrow and covered in wisteria. Like the rest of the residences along the graceful terrace, it was set several meters back from the street behind a wrought iron fence. An armored Bentley limousine stood outside, a chauffeur at the wheel. Directly behind the Bentley was a black Range Rover, occupied by four members of Orlov's security detail, all former members of Britain's elite Special Air Service, the SAS. King Saul Boulevard had discovered that the bodyguards were supplied by Exton Executive Security Services Limited, of Hill Street, Mayfair. Exton was regarded as the finest private security company in London. No small accomplishment in a city filled with many rich people worried about their safety. Gabriel was about to leave when he saw three bodyguards emerge from the Range Rover. One took up a post at the gate of number 43,
while the other two blocked the sidewalk in either direction. With the perimeter security in place, the front door of the house swung open, and Viktor Orlov stepped outside, flanked by two more bodyguards. Gabriel managed to see little of the famous Russian billionaire, other than a head of spiky gray hair and the flash of a pink necktie bound by an enormous Windsor knot. Orlov ducked into the back of the Bentley, and the doors quickly closed. A few seconds later, the motorcade was speeding along Royal Hospital Road. Gabriel sat on his bench for 10 more minutes, then got to his feet and headed back to Victoria. It took less than an hour for Heathrow security to produce the first batch of photographs of the man known only as Anatoly. Unfortunately, none were terribly helpful. Gabriel was not surprised. Everything about Anatoly suggested he was a professional. And like any good professional, he knew how to move through an airport without getting his picture taken. The fedora had done much to shield his face, but he had done a good deal of the work himself with subtle turns and movements. Still, the cameras made a valiant effort. Here a glimpse of a sturdy chin, here a partial profile, here a shot of a tight, uncompromising mouth. Flipping through the printouts in the Victoria safe house, Gabriel had a sinking feeling. Anatoly was a pro's pro, and he was playing the game with Yvonne's money. Both British services ran the photos through their databases of known Russian intelligence officers, but neither held out much hope for a match. Between them, they produced six possible candidates, all of whom were dismissed by Gabriel late that same night, at which point Seymour decided it was probably time to bring the dreaded Americans into the picture. Gabriel volunteered to make the trip himself. There was someone in America he was anxious to see. He hadn't spoken to her in months. She had written him a letter once, and he had painted her a painting. Chapter 30. CIA Headquarters, Virginia. Intelligence agencies refer to their spies in different ways. The office calls them gathering officers, and the department for which they work is referred to as collections. Spies for the CIA are known as case officers and are employed by the National Clandestine Service. Adrian Carter's tenure as chief of the NCS began when it was still known by its old name, the Directorate of Operations. Regarded as one of the agency's most accomplished secret warriors, Carter had left his fingerprints on every major American covert operation of the last two generations. He had tinkered with the odd election, toppled the odd democratically elected government, and turned a blind eye to more executions and murders than he cared to remember. "I did the Lord's work in Poland and propped up the devil's regime in El Salvador in the span of a single year," he once confessed to Gabriel in a moment of interagency candor. "And for an encore, I gave weapons to the Muslim holy warriors in Afghanistan, even though I knew that one day they would rain fire and death on me." Since the morning of September 11, 2001, Adrian Carter had been focused on primarily one thing, preventing another attack on the American homeland by the forces of global Islamic extremism. To accomplish that end, he had used tactics and methods even a battle-hardened covert warrior such as himself sometimes found objectionable. The black prisons, the renditions, the use of coercive interrogation techniques. It had all been made public, much to Carter's detriment. Well-meaning editorialists and politicians on Capitol Hill had been baying for Carter's blood for years. He should have been on the short list to become the CIA's next director. Instead, he lived in fear that one day he would be prosecuted for his actions in the global war against terrorism. Adrian Carter had kept America safe from its enemies, and for that, he would languish in the fires of hell for all eternity. He was waiting for Gabriel the following afternoon in a conference room on the 7th floor of CIA headquarters, the Valhalla of America's sprawling and often dysfunctional intelligence establishment. The antithesis of Graham Seymour in appearance, Carter had tousled, thinning hair and a prominent mustache that had gone out of fashion with disco music, crockpots, and the nuclear freeze. Dressed as he was now, in flannel trousers and a burgundy cardigan, he had the air of a professor from a minor university, the sort who championed noble causes and was a constant thorn in the side of his dean. He peered at Gabriel over his reading glasses, as if mildly surprised to see him, and offered his hand. It was cool as marble and dry to the touch. Gabriel had contacted Carter the previous day before leaving London via a secure cable, sent from the CIA station at the American Embassy. The cable had given Carter only the broadest outlines of the affair. Now Gabriel filled in the details. At the conclusion of the briefing, Carter picked through the physical evidence, beginning with the letter Grigori had left in Oxford, and ending with the Heathrow Airport surveillance photos of the man known only as Anatoly.
"In all honesty," said Carter, "we never put much stock in the story that Grigori had a change of heart and redefected to the motherland. As you might recall, I actually had a chance to spend some time with him the night you came out of Russia."
Gabriel did recall, of course. In a logistical feat only the agency could manage, Carter had put a squadron of Gulfstream executive jets on the ground in Kiev, just a few hours after the car bearing Gabriel and his trio of Russian defectors had crossed the Ukrainian border. Gabriel had returned to Israel, while Grigori and Olga had flown into exile in Britain. Carter had personally brought Elena Karkov to the United States, where she was granted defector status. Her current circumstances were so closely held that even Gabriel had no idea where the CIA had hidden her.
"We sent a team to debrief Grigori within 24 hours of his arrival in England," Carter resumed. "No one who took part ever voiced any skepticism about Grigori's authenticity. After his disappearance, I ordered a review of the tapes and transcripts to see if we'd missed something.
And?"
"Grigori was as good as gold. Needless to say, we were rather surprised when the British thought otherwise. As far as Langley is concerned, it seemed a rather transparent attempt to foist some of the blame for his disappearance onto you. They have no one to blame but themselves. He should have never been allowed to get mixed up with opposition types floating around London. It was only a matter of time before Ivan got to him."
"Is Ivan still a target of NSA surveillance?"
"Absolutely."
"Did you know he just sold several thousand anti-tank missiles and RPGs to Hezbollah?"
"We've heard rumors to that effect. But for the moment, keeping track of Ivan's business activities is low on our list of priorities. Our main concern is keeping his former wife and children safe from harm."
"Has he ever made any formal effort to reclaim them?"
"A couple of months ago, the Russian ambassador raised the issue during a routine meeting with the Secretary of State. The Secretary acted somewhat surprised and said she would look into the matter. She's a good poker player, the Secretary. Would have made an excellent case officer. A week later, she told the ambassador that Elena Karkov and her children were not currently residing in the United States, nor had they ever resided here at any time in the past. The ambassador thanked the Secretary profusely for her efforts and never raised the matter again."
"Ivan must know they're here, Adrian."
"Of course he knows, but there's nothing he and his friends in the Kremlin can do about it. That operation you ran in Saint-Tropez last summer was a thing of beauty. You plucked the children from Ivan cleanly and with a veneer of legality. Furthermore, when Ivan divorced Elena in a Russian court, he effectively gave up all legal claim to them. The only way he can get them now is to steal them, and that's not going to happen. We take better care of our defectors than the British do."
"She's somewhere safe, I hope."
"Very safe. But will you allow me to give you a piece of advice as one friend to another? Take Grigori's words to heart. Forget about that promise you made that night in Russia. Besides, I suspect Ivan has already put a bullet in the back of his head. Knowing Ivan, I imagine he did the deed himself. Go home to your wife and let the British clean up their mess."
"I like to keep promises. I used to think you did too, Adrian." Carter steepled his fingertips and pressed them to his chin.
"I think your characterization is a tad unfair, but since you put it that way, how can Langley be of service?"
"Give those photos of Anatoly to the Counterintelligence Center. See if they can put a name and a resume to that face.
I'll ask the chief to handle it personally."
Carter gathered up the photos.
"How long are you planning to stay in town?"
"As long as it takes.
One of our officers is about to leave on an overseas assignment. She was wondering if you might be free for dinner."
Gabriel didn't bother to ask the officer's name.
"Where's she going, Adrian?"
"That's classified.
I don't suppose I have to remind you that she was involved in the operation against Ivan?"
"No, you don't."
"So why are you letting her leave the country?"
"Your concern over her safety is touching, but completely unnecessary. What shall I tell her about dinner?"
Gabriel hesitated. "I'll take a rain check, Adrian. That's complicated."
"Why, because she's dating one of your team?"
"What are you talking about?"
"She and Mikhail are seeing each other. I'm surprised no one told you."
"How long has it been going on?"
"It started shortly after the Saint-Tropez operation. Since Mikhail is an employee of a foreign intelligence service, she was required to report the relationship to the Office of Personnel. Personnel wasn't pleased about it, but I intervened on their behalf.
How thoughtful of you, Adrian. Actually, I will have dinner with her.
Carter jotted the time and place on a slip of paper. Just be nice to her, Gabriel. I think she's happy. It's been a long time since Sarah has been happy.
Chapter 31. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. 1789 Restaurant, a Georgetown landmark, is regarded as one of the finest in Washington and is one of the few that still requires gentlemen to wear a jacket. With that admonition, Carter sent Gabriel to Brooks Brothers, where in the span of 10 minutes he picked out gabardine trousers, an Oxford cloth shirt, and the requisite blue blazer. He drew the line at a necktie, though. Like most Israelis, he wore them only under duress or for the purposes of cover. Besides, if he wore a tie, Sarah might get the wrong impression. The blazer was going to cause him enough problems. He arrived a few minutes early and was informed by the hostess that his dinner companion was already seated. He wasn't surprised. He had personally overseen Sarah Bancroft's training and regarded her as one of the finest natural operatives he had ever encountered. Multilingual, well-traveled, and extremely well-educated, she had been working as an assistant curator at the Phillips Collection in Washington when Gabriel recruited her to find a terrorist mastermind lurking in the entourage of Saudi billionaire Zizi al-Bakari. After the operation, Sarah joined the CIA on a full-time basis and was assigned to the Counterterrorism Center. Gabriel had borrowed her again the previous summer, and with the help of a forged painting, had placed her alongside Elena Kharkov. Mikhail had posed as Sarah's Russian-American boyfriend during the operation, and they had spent several nights together in a 5-star Saint-Tropez hotel. Gabriel reckoned the attraction had started then. He was not happy about it for a number of reasons, not least of which because it violated his ban on sexual relationships between members of his team. But his anger went only so far. He knew the unique combination of stress and boredom could sometimes lead to romantic entanglements in the field. In fact, he could speak from experience. 20 years earlier, while preparing for a major assassination in Tunis, he had an affair with his female escort officer that nearly destroyed his marriage to Leah. The hostess escorted him through the intimate dining room to a corner table near the fireplace. Sarah was seated along the banquette with her shoulders turned in a way that allowed her to discreetly survey the entire space. She was wearing a black sleeveless dress and a double strand of pearls. Her pale hair hung loosely about her shoulders, and her wide blue eyes shone with the warm light of the candles. One hand was resting on the stem of the martini glass. The other was placed lightly against her teardrop chin. Her cheek, when kissed, smelled of lilac.
"Can I get you one of these?"
she asked, tapping a manicured nail on the base of the glass.
"I'd rather drink your nail polish remover. Would you like that with a twist or just on the rocks?"
She looked up at the hostess.
"A glass of champagne, please. Something nice. He's had a long day."
The hostess withdrew. Sarah smiled and raised the martini to her lips.
"They say it's bad to drink the night before you fly, Sarah." "If I can survive one of your operations, I think I can survive a transatlantic flight with a bit of gin in my bloodstream."
"So it's Europe. Is that where Carter is sending you?"
"Adrian warned me to be on my toes around you. You're not going to get it out of me."
"I think I have a right to know."
"Really?"
She set down her glass and leaned forward over the table.
"You might find this difficult to believe, Gabriel, but I don't actually work for the office. I am employed by the National Clandestine Service of the Central Intelligence Agency, which means Adrian Carter, not you, makes my assignments."
"Would you like to say that a little louder? I'm not sure the cooks and dishwashers heard you."
"Weren't you the one who told me that nearly every important professional conversation you've ever had was conducted in public places?"
"It was true. Safe rooms were only safe if they hadn't been bugged." "At least rule out a couple of places for me. I'll sleep easier knowing that Langley, in its infinite wisdom, hasn't decided to send you to Saudi Arabia or Moscow."
"You may sleep in peace, because Langley has decided nothing of the sort."
"So it is Europe."
"Gabriel, really?"
"What kind of work will you be doing?" She gave an exasperated sigh.
It's related to my government's continuing effort to combat global terrorism."
"How gallant.
And to think that 4 years ago you were putting together an exhibition called Impressionists in Winter.
I hope that was meant as a compliment.
It was.
You obviously don't approve of my going into the field without you.
I've stated my concerns. But Adrian is your boss, not me. And if Adrian thinks it's appropriate, then who am I to question his judgment?
You're Gabriel Alon. That's who you are.
The waiter appeared. He gave them menus and a detailed briefing on the evening specials. When he was gone, Gabriel perused the entrees, and with as much detachment as he could manage, asked whether Mikhail was aware of Sarah's travel plans. Greeted by silence, he looked up and saw Sarah staring at him, her alabaster cheeks flushed. It's a good thing you didn't act like that when you were around Zizi and Yvonne, Gabriel said.
Did Mikhail tell you?
Actually, the chief of the National Clandestine Service let it slip in conversation. Sarah made no response. So it's true, then. You're actually dating a member of my team?
Are you jealous or angry?
Why on earth would I be jealous, Sarah?
I couldn't carry a torch for you forever. I had to move on.
And you couldn't find anyone else other than someone who works for me?
Funny how that worked out. I guess there was something about Mikhail that I found familiar.
Dating a man who's employed by the intelligence service of a foreign country isn't exactly a wise career move, Sarah.
Daniel is having trouble retaining bright young talent. They're willing to bend some of the old rules.
Maybe I should have a quiet word with personnel. They might have second thoughts.
You wouldn't dare, Gabriel. You also have no right to interfere in my private life.
Sarah's private life, Gabriel knew, had been largely in ruins since 9:03 on the morning of September 11, 2001. When United Airlines Flight 175 crashed into the south tower of the World Trade Center. On board the doomed aircraft was a young Harvard-trained lawyer named Ben Callahan. Ben had been able to make one call during the final moments of his life, and it had been to Sarah. Since that time, she had permitted herself to have feelings for only one other man. Unfortunately, that man had been Gabriel. You should think long and hard before you get involved with the man who kills people for a living. Mikhail's done a lot of terrible things for the sake of his country. Gabriel paused and then added, things that might make him difficult to be around sometimes.
Sounds like someone I know.
This isn't a joke, Sarah. This is your life. Besides, Israeli men are notoriously unreliable. Just ask your average Israeli woman.
The Israeli men I know are quite wonderful, actually.
That's because we're the best of the best.
Mikhail included?
He wouldn't be on my team if he wasn't.
How much time have you spent with him? He's come here a few times, and he met in Paris once.
It's not safe for you to be in Paris alone.
I'm not alone. I'm with Mikhail.
A silence, then.
It's almost like being with you.
Her words hung between them for a moment. Is that what this is about, Sarah?
Gabriel, please.
Because I'd feel bad if Mikhail got hurt in any way.
I'm sure I'm the only one who get hurt.
Not if I have anything to say about it. She smiled for the first time since Mikhail's name had come up.
I was going to tell you tonight. We were just waiting until we knew it was...
Her voice trailed off. Until it was what?
Real.
And is it? She held his hand.
Don't be upset, Gabriel. I was hoping this could be a celebration.
I'm not upset. She looked at the champagne glass. He hadn't touched it.
Do you want something else?
Nail polish remover. On the rocks, with a twist. Since Gabriel had come to Washington with the full knowledge of the CIA, housekeeping had assigned him a not-so-safe flat on Tunlaw Road north of Georgetown. In a somewhat curious twist of fate, the apartment overlooked the rear entrance of the Russian embassy. As Gabriel was crossing the lobby, his secure mobile vibrated in his coat pocket. It was Adrian Carter.
Where are you?
Gabriel told him. I have something you need to see right away. We'll pick you up. The connection went dead. 15 minutes later, Gabriel was climbing into the back of Carter's black sedan on New Mexico Avenue. Carter handed him a single sheet of paper, a transcript of the National Security Agency communications intercept, dated the previous evening, Moscow time. The target was Ivan Korkov. He had been speaking to someone inside FSB headquarters at Lubyanka Square. Though most of the conversation was conducted in coded colloquial Russian, it was clear Ivan had given something to the FSB, and he now wanted it back. That something was Grigory Bogdanov.
You're right, Gabriel. Ivan handed Grigory over to the FSB so they could settle accounts, too. Apparently, the FSB interrogation is going too slowly for Ivan's taste. He spent a great deal of money getting his hands on Grigory, and he's tired of waiting. But the good news is, Grigory's alive.
Is there any way you can prevail upon the FSB to keep him that way?
Not a chance. Our relations with the Russian services are getting worse by the day. There's no way they would tolerate our meddling in a strictly internal matter. And frankly, if the roles were reversed, neither would we. From their point of view, Grigory is a defector and a traitor. You can be sure they want to kill him just as much as Ivan does.
Does the CIC have anything for me?
Not yet. Who knows, maybe your friend Anatoly is a ghost.
I don't believe in ghosts, Adrian. If there's one thing we know about Ivan, he wouldn't have entrusted Grigory's kidnapping to someone he didn't know.
That's Ivan's way. Everything is personal.
So it's possible someone who spent a considerable amount of time around Ivan might have encountered this man at some point. Gabriel paused. Who knows, Adrian? She might even know his real name. Carter told the driver to head back to the safe flat, then looked at Gabriel.
A car will pick you up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning.
I'm afraid we'll have to play this one rather close to the vest. You won't know where you're going until you're airborne. How should I dress? Carter smiled.
Warmly. Very warmly.
Chapter 32. Upstate New York. The Adirondack Park, a vast wilderness area sprawling over 6 million acres in northeastern New York, is the largest public land preserve in the contiguous United States. Roughly the size of Vermont, it is larger than 7 other American states. So large, in fact, the national parks of Yellowstone, Yosemite, Glacier, the Grand Canyon, and the Great Smoky Mountains could all fit neatly within its boundaries. Gabriel had not known these facts until 1 hour after takeoff, when his pilot, a veteran of the CIA's rendition program, had finally revealed their destination. The forecast was rather grim, clear skies with a high temperature of perhaps 0. Gabriel assumed the pilot had converted the temperature from Fahrenheit to centigrade for the benefit of his foreign-born passenger. He hadn't. It was a few minutes after 10 when the plane touched down at the Adirondack Regional Airport outside Saranac Lake. Adrian Carter had arranged for a Ford Explorer to be left in the parking lot. By some miracle, the engine managed to start on the first attempt. Gabriel switched the heater to high and spent several deplorable minutes scraping ice from the windows. Climbing behind the wheel again, he could no longer feel his face. The temperature gauge of the Explorer indicated -8. Not possible, he thought. Surely it had to be instrument malfunction. Carter, a cautious soul if ever there was one, had decreed no one could approach the site with anything that transmitted or received a signal, including GPS navigation systems. Gabriel followed a set of typewritten instructions he had been given on board the plane. Leaving the airport, he turned right and followed Route 186 to Lake Clear. He made another right at Route 30 and headed toward Upper St. Regis Lake. Spitfire Lake came next, then Lower St. Regis, then the small college town of Paul Smith's. A few yards beyond the entrance of the college was Kesey Mills Road, a winding lane that ran eastward into one of the more remote corners of the preserve. Somewhere in this part of the Adirondacks, the Rockefellers had kept an immense summer retreat, complete with its own rail station to accommodate the private family train. Gabriel's destination, though far smaller than the Rockefeller estate, was scarcely less secluded. The entrance was on the left side of the road, and as Carter had warned, it was easy to miss. Gabriel sped past it the first time, and had to continue driving another quarter mile before finding a suitable place to execute a U-turn on the icy road. A narrow track ran straight into the thick woods for approximately 100 yards before encountering a metal security gate. No other fencing or barriers were visible, but Gabriel knew the grounds were littered with cameras, heat sensors, and motion detectors. Something had taken note of his approach, because the gate slid open even before he brought the SUV to a stop. On the other side, he saw a Jeep Grand Cherokee speeding toward him across a clearing. Behind the wheel was a man in his mid-50s with the bearing of a soldier. His name was Ed Fielding, a former officer in the CIA's Special Operations Group. Fielding was in charge of security.
We told you the entrance was hard to find.
Fielding said through his open window.
You were watching?
Fielding only smiled.
You remembered to leave your cell phone at home?
I remembered.
What about your BlackBerry?
Can't stand the things.
No secret pens or x-ray glasses?
The only thing electronic in my possession is my wristwatch, and I'd be happy to pitch it into a nearby lake if that would make you more comfortable.
As long as it isn't some secret Israeli device that transmits and receives a signal, you can keep it. Besides, all the lakes are frozen.
Fielding revved his engine.
We have a bit of driving to do. Stay close. Otherwise, you might get shot by the snipers.
Fielding accelerated hard across the clearing. By the time they reached the next line of trees, Gabriel had closed the gap. After a half mile, the road turned up a steep hill. Though plowed and sanded earlier that morning, the surface was already frozen solid. Fielding scaled it without incident, but Gabriel struggled to maintain traction. He switched the four-wheel drive setting from high to low and made a second attempt. This time, the tires bit into the ice, and the SUV muscled its way slowly toward the crest. In the 10 seconds it had taken to make the adjustment, Fielding had slipped away. Gabriel found him a moment later, paused at a fork in the road. They headed left and drove another 2 miles until they reached a clearing at the highest point of the estate. A large, traditional Adirondack lodge stood in the center, its soaring roof and sweeping porches facing southeast toward the faint warmth of the midday sun and the frozen lakes of St. Regis. A second lodge stood nearer the edge of the forest, smaller than the main house, but still grand in its own right. Between the two structures was a meadow, where two heavily bundled children were hard at work on a snowman, watched over by a tall, dark-haired woman in a shearling coat. Hearing the sound of approaching vehicles, she turned with an animal alertness, then, a few seconds later, lifted her hand dramatically into the air. Gabriel pulled up behind Fielding and switched off the engine. By the time he had opened the door, the woman was rushing toward him awkwardly through the knee-deep snow. She hurled her arms around his neck and kissed him elaborately on each cheek.
"Welcome to the one place in the world if only you'll ever find me," said Elena Karkov. "My God, Gabriel, I can't believe you're really here."
Chapter 33. Upstate New York. They had lunch in the large rustic dining room, beneath the traditional Adirondack antler chandelier. Elena sat against the soaring window, framed by the distant lakes. Anna, to her left, Nikolai, to her right. Though Gabriel had carried out what amounted to a legal kidnapping of the Karkov twins in the south of France the previous summer, he had never before seen them in person. He was struck now, as Sarah Bancroft had been upon meeting them for the first time, by their appearance. Anna, lanky and dark and blessed with a natural elegance, was a smaller version of her mother. Nikolai, fair and compact with a wide forehead and prominent brow, was the very likeness of his notorious father. Indeed, throughout an otherwise pleasant meal, Gabriel had the uncomfortable feeling that Ivan Karkov, his most implacable enemy, was scrutinizing his every move from the other side of the table. He was struck, too, by the sound of their voices. Their English was perfect and had only the faintest trace of a Russian accent. It was not surprising, he thought. In many respects, the Karkov children were scarcely Russian at all. They had spent most of their lives in a Knightsbridge mansion and had attended an exclusive London school. In winter, they had holidayed in Courchevel. In summer, they trooped south to Villa Soleil, Ivan's palace by the sea in Saint-Tropez. As for Russia, it was a place they had visited a few weeks each year, just to keep in touch with their roots. Anna, the more talkative of the two, spoke of her native country as though it were something she had read about in books. Nikolai said little. He just stared at Gabriel a great deal, as if he suspected the unexplained lunch guest was somehow to blame for the fact he now lived on a mountaintop in the Adirondacks, instead of West London in the south of France. When the meal was concluded, the children kissed their mother's cheek and dutifully carried their dishes into the kitchen.
"It took a little time for them to get used to life without servants," Elena said when they were gone. "I think it's better they live like normal children for a while."
She smiled at the absurdity of her statement.
"Well, almost normal."
"How have they handled the adjustment?"
"As well as one might expect under the circumstances. Their lives as they knew them ended in the blink of an eye, all because their Russian bodyguards were stopped for speeding while leaving the beach in Saint-Tropez. I suspect they were the only people pulled over for speeding in the south of France the entire summer."
Gendarmes can be rather unpredictable in their enforcement of traffic regulations.
They can also be very kind. They took good care of my children when they were in custody. Nikolai still speaks fondly of the time he spent in the Saint-Tropez Gendarmerie. He also enjoyed the monastery in the Alps. As far as the children were concerned, their escape was all a big adventure. And I have you to thank for that, Gabriel. You made it very easy on them.
How much do they know about what happened to their father?
They know he had some trouble with his business. And they know he divorced me in order to marry his friend, Yekaterina. As for the arms trafficking and the killings...
Her voice trailed off.
They're far too young to understand. I'll wait until they're a bit older before telling them the truth. Then they can come to their own conclusions.
Surely they must be curious.
Of course they are. They haven't seen or spoken to Ivan for 6 months. It's been hard on Nikolai. He idolizes his father. I'm sure he blames me for his absence.
How do you explain the fact that you live in isolation, surrounded by bodyguards?
That part is actually not so hard. Anna and Nikolai are the children of a Russian oligarch. They spent their entire lives surrounded by men with guns and radios, so it seems perfectly natural to them. As for the isolation, I tell them it's only temporary. Someday soon they'll be allowed to have friends and go to school like normal American children. For now, they have a lovely tutor from the CIA. She works with him from 9 until 3. Then I make sure they go outside and play, regardless of the weather. We have several thousand acres, 2 lakes and a river. There's plenty for the children to do. It's heaven. But I would never have been able to afford it if not for you and your helpers.
Elena was referring to the team of office cyber specialists, who in the days after her defection had raided Ivan's bank accounts in Moscow and Zurich and made off with more than $20 million in cash. The unauthorized wire transfers, as they were euphemistically referred to at Kingsall Boulevard, were one of many actions connected to the affair that skirted the edge of legality. In the aftermath, Yvonne had been in no position to quibble over the missing money or to question the sequence of events that led to the loss of custody of his 2 children. He was dealing with charges in the West that he had sold some of Russia's deadliest anti-aircraft missiles to the terrorists of Al-Qaeda, a sale concluded with the blessing of the Kremlin and the Russian president himself. Adrian tells me the CIA agreed to provide protection for you and the children for only 2 years, Gabriel said.
You obviously don't think that's long enough.
No, I don't.
The American taxpayer can't pay the bill forever. When the CIA men leave, I'll hire my own bodyguards.
What happens when the money runs out?
I suppose I could always sell the painting you forged for me.
She smiled.
Would you like to see it?
She led him into the great room and stopped before a precise copy of 2 Children on a Beach by Mary Cassatt. It was the second version of the painting Gabriel had produced. The first had been sold to Ivan Karkov for $2.5 million and was now in the possession of French prosecutors. I'm not sure it matches the Adirondack decor.
I don't care. I'm keeping it right where it is.
He placed his hand to his chin and tilted his head to one side. I think it's better than the first one, don't you?
Your brush strokes were a bit too impossible in the first version. This one is perfect.
She looked at him.
But I don't suppose you came all this way to talk about my children, or to hear me criticize your work.
Gabriel was silent. Elena gazed at the painting.
You know, Gabriel, you really should have been an artist. You could have been great. And with a bit of luck, you would have never had the misfortune of meeting my husband.
More than 100 intelligence professionals from 4 countries had been involved in the Karkov affair. And most were still vexed by a single question. Why had Elena Varlamova, the beautiful and cultured daughter of a Communist Party economic planner from Leningrad, ever married a hood like Ivan in the first place? He had been working for the notorious 5th Directorate of the KGB at the time of their wedding and seemed destined for a glittering career. But in the late 1980s, as the Soviet Union lay wheezing on its deathbed, his fortunes took a sudden and unexpected turn. In a desperate bid to breathe life into the moribund Soviet economy, Mikhail Gorbachev had introduced economic reforms that allowed the limited formation of investment capital. With the encouragement of his superiors, Ivan left the KGB and created one of Russia's first privately owned banks. Aided by the hidden hand of his old colleagues, it was soon wildly profitable, and when the Soviet Union finally breathed its last,
Ivan was uniquely positioned to snatch up some of its most valuable assets. Among them was a fleet of transport ships and aircraft, which he converted into one of the largest freight forwarding companies in the world. Before long, Ivan's boats and planes were bound for destinations in Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, laden with one of the few products the Russians made well, weapons. Ivan liked to boast he could lay his hands on anything and ship it anywhere, in some cases, overnight. He cared nothing about morality, only money. He would sell to anyone, as long as they could pay. And if they couldn't, he offered to arrange financing through his banking arm. He sold his weapons to dictators, and he sold them to rebels. He sold to freedom fighters with legitimate grievances, and to genocidal maniacs who slaughtered women and children. He specialized in providing weapons to regimes so beyond the pale they were unable to obtain arms from legal sources. He perfected the practice of selling weapons to both sides of a conflict, judiciously moderating the flow of arms in order to prolong the killing and maximize his profits. He destroyed countries. He destroyed peoples. And he became filthy rich in the process. For years he had managed to keep his network of death carefully concealed. To the rest of the world, Ivan Kharkov was the very symbol of the new Russia, a shrewd investor and businessman who easily straddled east and west, collecting expensive homes, luxury yachts, and beautiful mistresses. Elena would later admit to Gabriel that she had been an enabler of Ivan's grand deception. She had turned a blind eye to his romantic dalliances, just as she had shrouded herself in a willful ignorance when it came to the true source of his immense wealth. But lives are sometimes upended in an instant. Gabriel's had changed one evening in Vienna, in the time it took a detonator to ignite a charge of plastic explosive placed beneath his car. For Elena Kharkov, it was the night she overheard a telephone conversation between her husband and his chief of security, Arkady Medvedev. Confronted with the possibility that thousands of innocent people might die because of her husband's greed, she chose to betray him rather than remain silent. Her actions led her to an isolated villa in the hills above Saint-Tropez, where she offered to help Gabriel steal Ivan's secrets. The operation that followed had nearly ended both of their lives. One image would hang forever in Gabriel's terrible gallery of memory, the image of Elena Kharkov, tied to a chair in her husband's warehouse, with Arkady Medvedev's pistol pressed to the side of her head. Arkady wanted Gabriel to reveal the location of Anna and Nikolai. Elena was prepared to die rather than answer.
"You better pull the trigger, Arkady, because Ivan is never getting those children."
Now seated before a fire in the great room of the Adirondack Lodge, Gabriel broke the news that Ivan had succeeded in kidnapping Grigory Bolgonov, the man who had saved their lives that night, and that Olga Sukova, Elena's old friend from Leningrad State, had been the target of an assassination attempt in Oxford. Elena took the news calmly, as though she had been informed of a long-expected death. Then she accepted a photograph, a man standing in the arrivals hall of Heathrow Airport. The sudden darkening of her expression instantly told Gabriel his journey had not been in vain.
"You've seen him before?"
Elena nodded.
"In Moscow, a long time ago. He was a regular visitor to our house in Zhukova."
"Did he come alone?" She shook her head.
"Only with Arkady."
"Were you ever told his name?"
"I was never told their names."
"And you never happened to overhear one?"
"I'm afraid not."
Gabriel tried to conceal his disappointment and asked whether Elena could recall anything else. She looked down at the photograph as if trying to wipe the dust from her memory.
"I remember that Arkady was always quite deferential in his presence. I found it rather odd, because Arkady was deferential in front of no one."
She looked up at Gabriel.
"Too bad you killed him. He could have told you the name."
"The world is a much better place without the likes of Arkady Medvedev."
"That's true. Sometimes I actually wish I'd killed him myself."
She turned her head and stared across the room toward the painting.
"The question is, has Ivan hired the same man to take my children from me?"
Gabriel took hold of Elena's hand and gave it a reassuring squeeze. "I've experienced Adrian's security firsthand. There's no way Ivan will ever find you and the children here."
"I'd feel better knowing you were here."
She looked at him.
"Will you stay with us, Gabriel, just for a day or two?"
"I'm not sure Grigory has a day or two to spare."
"Grigory."
She gazed despondently into the fire.
I know what my husband and his friends from the FSB do to those who betray them. You should forget about Grigori. Better to focus on the living.
Chapter 34, Upstate New York. Gabriel agreed to spend the night and returned to Washington the next morning. After settling into a second-floor guest room, he went in search of a telephone. As a security precaution, Fred Fielding had removed all the phones from the main lodge. Indeed, only one telephone on the entire property was capable of reaching the outside world. It was located in the second lodge, on the desk in Fielding's office. A small sign warned that all calls, regardless of origin or destination, were monitored and recorded.
It's no joke,
Fielding said as he handed Gabriel the receiver, as one professional to another. Fielding stepped outside and closed the door. Unwilling to betray normal office communication procedures, Gabriel dialed King Saul Boulevard on a business line and asked for Uzi Naboth. Their conversation was brief and conducted in a form of Hebrew no NSA supercomputer could ever decipher. In the space of a few seconds, Naboth managed to give Gabriel a thorough update. Irina Bolganova was safely on the ground in Moscow. Gabriel's team was headed back to Israel, and Kiara was on her way back to Umbria, accompanied by her bodyguards. In fact, Naboth added after checking the time, they were probably there by now. Gabriel severed the connection and debated whether to ring her. He decided it wasn't safe. Making contact with the office on an agency line was one thing, but calling Kiara at home or on her mobile was quite another. He would have to wait until he was outside the CIA's bubble before trying to reach her. Replacing the receiver, he thought of the words Elena had just spoken. You should forget about Grigori. Better to focus on the living. Perhaps she was right. Perhaps he had made a promise he couldn't possibly keep. Perhaps it was time to go home and look after his wife. He opened the door and stepped into the corridor. Fred Fielding was there, leaning against the wall.
Everything okay?
Everything's fine.
Feel like taking a ride?
Where?
I know you're concerned about Elena. I thought I'd put your mind at ease by showing you some of our security measures.
Even though I work for a foreign service.
ABN says your family, that's all I need to know.
Gabriel followed Fielding into the bitter late afternoon cold. He had expected the tour to be conducted by jeep. Instead, Fielding escorted him to an outbuilding where two snowmobiles glistened beneath overhead fluorescent lights. From a metal cabinet, the CIA man produced a pair of helmets, two parkas, two neoprene face masks, and two pairs of windstopper gloves. 5 minutes later, after a perfunctory lesson on the operation of a snowmobile, Gabriel was hurtling through the woods in Fielding's blizzard-like wake, bound for a distant corner of the estate. They inspected the westernmost edge of the property first, then the southern border, which was marked by a branch of the St. Regis River. 2 weeks earlier, a black bear had crossed onto the estate from the other side of the stream and triggered the motion detectors and infrared heat sensors. Fielding had responded to the intrusion by dispatching a pair of guards, who confronted the bear within 30 seconds of its arrival. Faced with the prospect of becoming a rug, the bear had wisely retreated to the other side of the stream and had not been seen since. Are there any other wild animals we need to worry about? Asked Gabriel.
Just deer, bobcats, beavers, and the occasional wolf.
Wolves?
We had one just the other day, a big one.
Are they dangerous?
Only if you surprise them.
Fielding twisted the throttle and vanished in a cloud of white. Gabriel followed him along the winding bank of the stream bed to the eastern edge of the property. It was marked by a chain-link fence topped by barbed wire. Every 50 yards or so was a sign warning that the property was private, and that anyone foolish enough to attempt a crossing would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. As they sped side by side along the fence, Gabriel noticed Fielding talking over his radio. By the time they reached the road, it was clear something was wrong. Fielding stopped and motioned for Gabriel to do the same.
You have a phone call.
Gabriel didn't have to ask who had placed the call. Only one person knew where he was or how to reach him. What's it about?
He didn't say. He wants to talk to you right away, though.
Fielding led Gabriel back to the compound by the shortest route possible. It was dusk when they arrived, and the two Adirondack lodges were little more than silhouettes against the fiery horizon. Elena Karkov stood on the porch of the main house, her arms folded beneath her breasts, her long dark hair moving in the frigid wind,
Gabriel and Fielding swept past her without a word and entered the staff lodge. The telephone in Fielding's office was off the hook. Gabriel raised the receiver swiftly to his ear and heard the voice of Adrian Carter. If there was indeed a recording of the conversation that followed, it did not exist for long. Carter would never speak of it, except to say that it was among the most difficult of his long career. The only other witness was Ed Fielding. The security man could not hear Carter's words, but he could see the terrible toll they were taking. He saw a hand gripping the telephone with such force the knuckles were white. And he saw the eyes, the unusually bright green eyes now burning with a terrifying rage. As Fielding slipped quietly from the room, he realized he had never seen such rage before. He did not know what his friend Adrian Carter was saying to the legendary Israeli assassin, but he was certain of one thing. Blood was going to flow, and men were going to die. Part 3. All Even. Chapter 35. Tiberias, Israel. Ari Shamron had long ago lost the gift of sleep. Like most men, it had been taken from him late in life, but for reasons that were uniquely his. He had told so many lies, spun so many deceptions, he could no longer tell fact from fiction, truth from untruth. Condemned by his work to remain forever awake, Shamron spent nights wandering ceaselessly through the secure file rooms of his past, reliving old cases, walking old battlefields, confronting enemies long since vanquished. And then there was the telephone. Throughout Shamron's long and turbulent career, it had rung at the most appalling hours, usually with word of death. Because he had devoted his life to safeguarding the state of Israel, and by extension the Jewish people, the calls had been a veritable catalog of horrors. He had been told about acts of war and acts of terror, of hijackings and murderous suicide bombings, of embassies and synagogues reduced to rubble. And once, many years earlier, he had been awakened by the news that a man he adored as a son had just lost his family in a car bombing in Vienna. But the call from Uzi Mavot that arrived late that evening was nearly one too many. It caused Shamron to unleash a cry of rage and to seize his chest in anguish. Yila, who was lying beside him at the time, would later say she feared her husband was having another heart attack. Shamron quickly steadied himself and snapped off a few brisk commands before gently hanging up the phone. He remained motionless for a long moment, his breathing rapid and shallow. There was a ritual in the Shamron household. At the termination of such telephone calls, Gila would usually pose a single question. How many dead this time? But Gila could tell by her husband's reaction that this call was different. So she reached out in the darkness and touched the papery skin of his hollowed cheek. For only the second time in their marriage, she felt tears.
What is it, Ari? What happened?
Hearing his answer, she raised both hands to her face and wept.
Where is he?
America.
Does he know yet?
He's just been told.
Is he coming home?
He'll be here by morning.
Do we know who did it?
We have a good idea.
What are you going to do?
Amos doesn't want me around. He thinks I'll be a distraction.
Who is Amos to tell you what to do? Gabriel is like a son to you. Tell Amos he can go to hell. Tell him you're coming back to Kingston Boulevard.
Shamron was silent for a moment.
Maybe he won't want me there.
Who?
Gabriel.
Why would you say that, Harry?
Because if I hadn't...
His voice trailed off.
Because if you hadn't recruited him a long time ago, none of this would have ever happened? Is that what you were going to say?
Shamron made no response.
Gabriel is more like you than he realizes. He has no choice but to fight. None of us do.
Gila wiped the tears from her husband's cheeks.
Get out of bed, Ari. Go to Tel Aviv and make sure you're waiting at Ben-Gurion when he arrives. He needs to see a familiar face.
She paused, then said,
he needs to see his Abba.
Shamron sat up and swung his feet slowly to the floor.
Can I make you some coffee or something to eat?
There isn't time.
Let me get you some clean clothes.
Gila switched on her lamp and climbed out of bed. Chamron snatched up the receiver of his telephone again and placed a call to the guard shack at the foot of his drive. It was answered by Rami, the longtime chief of his permanent security detail.
Get the car ready,
Chamron said. Something wrong, boss?
It's Gabriel. You'll never rest soon enough.
Chamron hung up the phone and got to his feet. By then, Gila had his clothes laid out at the foot of the bed. Pressed khaki trousers, an Oxford cloth shirt, a leather bomber jacket with a tear in the right breast. Chamron reached down and tugged at it gently.
We'll wage one more fight together, he thought. One last operation.
He lit a cigarette and dressed slowly, as if armoring himself for the battle ahead. Pulling on his jacket, he made his way to the kitchen, where Gila was brewing a pot of coffee.
I told you there isn't time.
It's for me, Ari.
You should go back to bed, Gila.
I won't be able to sleep now.
She looked at the cigarette burning between his yellowed fingers, but knew better than to scold him.
Try not to smoke too much, the doctor says.
I know what he says.
She kissed his cheek.
You call me when you can.
I'll call.
Chamron stepped outside. The house faced east, toward the Sea of Galilee and the looming dark mass of the Golan Heights. Chamron had bought it many years ago because it allowed him to keep watch on Israel's enemies. Tonight, those enemies were beyond the horizon. By their actions, they had just declared war on the office, and now the office would make war on them in return. Chamron's armored limousine was waiting in the drive. Rami helped him into the back before settling into the front passenger seat. As the car lurched forward, the bodyguard shot a glance over his shoulder and asked where they were going.
Things are over.
Rami gave a terse nod. Chamron reached for his secure phone and pressed the speed dial button. The voice that answered was young, male, and impertinent. It immediately set Shamron's teeth on edge. Making mincemeat of such voices was one of his favorite pastimes.
I need to speak to him right away.
He's asleep.
Not for long.
He asked not to be disturbed unless it's a matter of national crisis.
Then I suggest you wake him.
But that'll be important.
The aide placed Chamron on hold. Never a good idea. 30 seconds later, another voice came on the line. Heavy with sleep, it belonged to Israel's prime minister.
What is it, Ari?
We lost two boys in Italy tonight,
Chamron said.
And Gabriel's wife is missing.
It was Margarita, the housekeeper who had made the discovery. Later, under questioning from Italian authorities, she would place the time at perhaps 10:05, though she admitted to not having checked her wristwatch. The time happened to correspond satisfactorily to her mobile phone records, which showed she placed her first call at 10:07. The time also dovetailed well with her movements that night. Several witnesses would recall seeing her leave a cafe in Amelia at roughly 9:50 p.m., leaving her plenty of time to make the drive back to Villa De Fiori aboard her little motor scooter. The first indication of trouble, she said, was the presence of a car outside the security gate. A Fiat sedan, it was parked at a drunken angle. Nose against a tree, headlamps doused. She told the police she assumed it had been abandoned or involved in a minor accident. Rather than approach the car, she had first illuminated it with the beam of her headlamp. It was then she noticed the broken windows and the bits of safety glass scattered over the ground like crystals. She also realized the car was familiar. It belonged to the two friends of the restorer, the young men with odd names who spoke no known language. She told the police she had never truly believed their story. Her father had been a soldier, she said, and she knew a couple of security guards when she saw them. Dismounting the bike, she had hurried over to the car to see if anyone was injured. What she had found, she said, was clearly no accident. Both men had been shot many times and were drenched in blood. Though Margarita was the first to be questioned by the police, she had not actually been the one to summon them. Like the other members of the staff, she had been given strict instructions about what to do in the event of any incident involving the restorer or his wife. She was to telephone Count Gaspari, the villa's absentee owner, and inform him first, which she had done at 10:07. The Count had then placed a hasty call to Monsignor Luigi Donati, private secretary to His Holiness Pope Paul VII, and Donati had contacted the Vatican Security Office. Within 20 minutes, units of both the Polizia di Stato and the Carabinieri had arrived at the villa's entrance and cordoned off the scene. Unable to locate the keys to the vehicle, the officers had opened the trunk by force. Inside, they had found three suitcases, one filled with the belongings of a woman and a woman's handbag. The commanding officer had quickly surmised that the crime scene represented more than just a double homicide. It appeared there had been a woman in the car, and the woman was now missing. Unbeknownst to the officers at the scene, a quiet call had already been placed from the Vatican to the woman's employers in Tel Aviv. The officer who had taken the call immediately telephoned Uzi Nabok, who was at that moment heading toward his home in the Tel Aviv suburb of Petah Tikva. He swung a reckless U-turn and drove dangerously fast back to King Saul Boulevard. Along the way, he placed three calls from his secure phone, one to Adrian Carter at Langley, the next to the director of the office, and a third to the Mamuna, the one in charge. As for Gabriel, he was largely unaware of the storm swirling around him. Indeed, at the same moment Chamron was rousing the Prime Minister from his sleep, he was doing his best to console a distraught Elena Korkov. Her two children, Anna and Nikolai, were playing quietly in the next room, oblivious as to what had just transpired. Precisely what was said between Gabriel and Elena would never be known. They emerged from the lodge together a short time later, Elena in tears, Gabriel looking stoic, with his overnight bag slung over his shoulder. By the time he arrived at Adirondack Regional Airport, his plane was fueled and cleared for takeoff. It took him directly to Andrews Air Force Base, where a second aircraft, a Gulfstream G-500, was on standby to ferry him home. The crew would later report that he took no food or drink during the 10-hour flight, and spoke not a single word. He just sat in his seat like a statue, staring out the window into the blackness. Chapter 36. Ben-Gurion Airport, Israel. There is a room at Ben-Gurion Airport known only to a handful of people. It is located to the left of passport control, behind an unmarked door kept locked at all times. Its walls are faux Jerusalem limestone. Its furnishings are typical airport fare, black vinyl couches and chairs, modular end tables, cheap modern lamps that cast an unforgiving light. There are two windows, one looking onto the tarmac, the other onto the arrivals hall. Both are fashioned of high-quality one-way glass. Reserved for office personnel, it is the first stop for operatives returning from secret battlefields abroad. There is a permanent odor of stale cigarettes, burnt coffee, and male tension. The cleaning staff has tried every product imaginable to expel it, but the smell remains. Like Israel's enemies, it cannot be defeated by conventional means. Gabriel had entered this room, or versions of it, many times before. He had entered it in triumph, and staggered into it in failure. He had been fated in this room, and once he had been wheeled in with a bullet still lodged in his chest. Now, for the second time in his life, he entered after men of indiscriminate violence had targeted his wife. Only Chamron was there to greet him. Chamron might have said many things. He might have said that none of this would have happened if Gabriel had come home to Israel, or that Gabriel had been a fool to go chasing after a Russian defector like Grigori. But he didn't. In fact, for a long moment he said nothing at all. He just laid his hand on Gabriel's cheek and stared into the green eyes. They were bloodshot and red-rimmed from anger and exhaustion.
"I don't suppose you managed to sleep."
The eyes answered for him.
"You didn't eat either. You have to eat, Gabriel. I'll eat when I get her back. The professional in me wants to say we should let someone else handle this, but I know that isn't an option."
Chamron took hold of Gabriel's elbow.
"Your team is waiting for you. They're very anxious to get started. We have a great deal of work to do, and very little time."
Stepping outside, they were greeted by a raw blast of wind-blown rain. Gabriel looked at the sky. No moon or stars, just leaden clouds stretching from the coastal plain to the Judean hills.
"It's snowing in Jerusalem," Chamron said. "Down here, only rain."
He paused.
"And missiles. Last night Hamas let loose from Gaza with some of their longer-range rockets. 5 people were killed in Ashkelon, An entire family wiped out. One of the children was handicapped. Apparently, they couldn't make it into the shelters quickly enough.
Shenron's limousine was parked curbside in the secure VIP area. Rami stood at the open door, hands at his sides, face grim. As Gabriel slipped into the back, the bodyguard gave his arm a reassuring squeeze, but said nothing. A moment later, the car was speeding along the circular airport access road through the driving rain. At the end of the road was a blue and white sign. To the right was Jerusalem, city of believers. To the left was Tel Aviv, city of action. The limousine headed left. Shimon ignited a cigarette and brought Gabriel up to date.
Shimon Pasner has set up shop inside the headquarters of the Polizia di Stato. He's monitoring the Italian search efforts on a minute-by-minute basis and filing regular updates with the operations desk.
Pasner was the Rome station chief. He and Gabriel had had the odd professional altercation over the years, but Gabriel trusted him with his life, and Chiara's too.
Shimon has also conducted quiet conversations with the heads of both the Italian services. They've sent their condolences and pledged to do everything in their power to help.
I hope he didn't feel obligated to say anything about my recent visit to Como. Under my agreement with the Italians, I'm barred from operating on Italian soil.
He didn't. But I wouldn't worry too much about the Italians. They're not going back there any time soon.
How did he explain the fact that Chiara was traveling with bodyguards?
He told them we'd picked up some threats against you.
He didn't go into specifics. How did the Italians react?
As you might expect, they were somewhat disappointed. We hadn't mentioned it earlier. But their first concern is trying to locate your wife. We've told them we believe the Russians are involved. Ivan's name hasn't come up. Not yet.
It's important the Italians handle this quietly.
They will. The last thing they want is for the world to discover you've been living on a farm in Umbria restoring paintings for the Pope. The Polizia di Stato and Carabinieri officers on the ground believe the victim was an ordinary Italian woman. Higher up the chain of command, they know there's a national security connection of some sort. Only the chiefs and the top aides know the truth.
What steps are they taking?
They are conducting a search in the area surrounding the villa, and have officers at every point of entry and border crossing. They can't search every vehicle, but they're running spot checks and tearing apart anything that looks remotely suspicious. Apparently, the truck traffic heading toward the Swiss tunnels is backed up for more than an hour.
Do they know anything about how the operation went down?
Shimon shook his head. No one saw a thing. They think Lior and Motti had been dead for a couple of hours before the housekeeper found them. Whoever did this was good. Lior and Motti never managed to get a shot off.
Where are their bodies?
They've been moved to Rome. The Italians will release them to us later this morning. They're hoping to do it quietly, but I doubt they'll be able to keep a lid on it much longer. Someone in the press is bound to get wind of it soon.
I want them buried as heroes, Harry. They didn't deserve to die like this. If I hadn't...
You did what you thought was right, Gabriel. And don't worry, those boys will be buried with honor on the Mount of Olives.
Shimon hesitated, then said,
"Near your son."
Gabriel looked out the window. He was grateful for the Italian effort, but feared it was little more than wasted time. He didn't have to voice the sentiment aloud. Shimon, by his dour expression, knew it to be true. He crushed out his cigarette and immediately lit another.
"Have you given any thought to how Ivan found her?"
"I've thought of nothing else, Eri. Other than getting her back.
Perhaps they followed Irina when you brought her to Italy."
"It's possible."
"What?"
"Extremely unlikely. Moscow Station watched Irina for several days before she left Russia. She was clean."
"Would they have had a team waiting at the Milan airport and followed you to the villa?"
"We set up a surveillance detection route. There's no way we would have missed the Russian tail."
"Maybe they did it electronically."
"With a beacon?" Gabriel shook his head. "We checked her out before we ever left the airport. Her luggage contained no transmitters. We did everything by the book, Harry. I suspect Ivan and his friends in Russian intelligence have known my whereabouts for a long time."
"So why didn't he just kill you and be done with it?"
"I'm sure we'll know soon enough." The limousine headed onto an exit ramp, and a moment later was speeding north along Highway 20. To the left lay Tel Aviv and its suburbs. To the right was a towering gray wall separating Israel from the West Bank.
there were some in Israel's defense and security establishment who referred to it as the Shamron Fence, because he had spent years advocating its construction. The separation barrier had helped to drastically reduce acts of terrorism, but it caused much damage to the country's already low standing abroad. Shamron never allowed important decisions to be influenced by international opinion. He operated by a simple maxim: do what is necessary, and worry about cleaning up the mess later. Gabriel would operate by the same doctrine now.
Have we gone on record with the Russians yet?
We summoned the ambassador to the foreign ministry last night and read him the riot act. We told him that we believe Ivan Karkov is responsible for Kiara's disappearance, and made it clear we expect her to be released immediately.
How did the ambassador react?
He said he was certain we were wrong, but promised to look into the matter. The formal denial came this morning.
Ivan had nothing to do with it, of course.
Of course. But I'm afraid it gets better. The FSB has offered to help locate Kiara.
Oh, really? And what would they like in return?
All information pertaining to her disappearance, plus the names of everyone who took part in the operation against Ivan in Moscow last summer.
That means Ivan is acting with the Kremlin's blessing.
Without question. It also means we'll have to treat the Russian services as adversaries. Fortunately, you have friends in London and Washington. Graham Seymour says the British services will do whatever they can to help. And Adrian Carter has already sent a cable to all his stations and bases regarding Kiara's abduction. He'll pass along anything the CIA happens to pick up.
I need complete coverage of all of Ivan's communications.
You've already got it. All relevant NSA intercepts will be turned over to our station chief in Washington.
Shimon paused.
The question is, what does Ivan want? And when are we going to hear from him?
The car exited Highway 20 and spiraled down onto a rain-swept avenue in North Tel Aviv. Shamron placed a hand on Gabriel's arm.
This is not the way I wanted you to come back here, my son. But welcome home.
Gabriel looked out the window at a passing street sign. Sderot Shol Hamlet, King Saul Boulevard.